Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us on Lit Radio podcast. I'm Teja, and today I'm joined by Thomas Mata. He's the author of Your Path to Prosperity, How to Find a Happy and Long Life. Tom is head of Money Mindshift at Aegon UK, where he works at the intersection of financial well-being, behavioral science, and longevity education. He's also a researcher, podcaster, and speaker who helps shift the way we think about money. He holds a PhD in social anthropology from Humboldt University in Berlin. In Your Path to Prosperity, Tom unpacks why money choices are so overwhelming and why we are wired to struggle with them. The book reminds us that money is essential, but the real asset is self-knowledge, understanding your money mindset, what makes you happy, how you deal with uncertainty, and how you connect with your future self. Hi Tom, it's a great pleasure to have you with us on the Lit Radio podcast. How are you today?
It's great to be here. Thank you very much. I'm great. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So I'm really excited to speak with you about your book, Your Path to Prosperity, because it's a topic I'm really interested in. So first of all, could you tell us how you decided to write it?
Yeah, sure. So I obviously have done a lot of work in this subject, already. So I'm a researcher by training, and over the last 5-6 years or so, I have done a lot of work in the financial well-being space. We discovered some sort of niches in the way financial well-being was being discussed. And I suspect, you write the books, that need to be written and that you feel, don't exist. So I wanted to summarize my thinking, my observations, my findings, but crucially also, I wanted to write down these thoughts in a much more creative way. So this is why, in addition to all the latest findings from behavioral finance and psychology and neuroscience and anthropology, there's a lot of storytelling in there, and there's a lot of sort of exploration and I hope creative elements that bring the subject to life rather than it just being a sort of heavy egg-headed, this is how we ought to think about this subject.
Yeah, actually, that's what I really like about this book, the mix of storytelling and education. So, yeah, I think you've achieved a great mix.
Thank you.
What was like writing the book? What was your process? How did it all became together?
Yeah, so how did it come together? So I was less rigid than on the first book. So I've written another book on financial well-being that's just been published in Germany. And with that one, I was really rigid. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I had like 3-4 hours in the morning between 5 and 8 or so before the family got up that I wrote this. This time I was a bit more flexible, I suppose. So I was carrying many ideas for chapters with me. Different chapters were progressed at different points in time. I will confess there was a bit of sense checking and exploration and brainstorming with AI as well. So I did that as well. I find AI quite useful as a sort of thinking partner on occasion. So it was more explorative and flexible, I suppose, rather than rigid and very sort of detailed. What's the word I'm looking for? Prescribed. A more flexible, creative approach this time, I'd say. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, what you're saying that because you've obviously written a few books, so it's very interesting. You had different processes, because usually when I speak with other authors, they usually follow one structure on one process. So yeah, it's interesting that you can do two different things, and so yeah, it works well. All right, so let's talk about the content of the book, Tom. And very interestingly, You say that people shouldn't be going after financial independence, which is what we've been seeing on social media. Everybody's saying you should be financially independent and have control over your time and so on. But you're saying people should actually be working towards financial well-being. Why is that?
Yeah, so I think we have a bit of a limited way to be thinking about the opposite of financial dependence, right? So obviously, when I say I'm not in favor of financial independence, I'm not saying I'm in favor of financial dependence. Yeah, but I don't think it has to be binary. Yeah, so you're either financially dependent or financially independent. And what I think I find fault with oftentimes with the debate around financial independence is that it kind of suggests that, you know, there is a point where, boom, all of a sudden you're financially independent and then you don't have any worries anymore. Yeah. And I think it is a bit unrealistic. I use the example of, you know, imagine you have a very introverted friend, who is very shy and, you know, always struggles when being together with others. Now, you wouldn't recommend that friend to become socially independent. Yeah, because, you know, it's impossible. You cannot be socially independent. The same applies, I think, to financial independence. You can never be independent of the money. You will always need the money to an extent. So this is why I don't believe you really aim for financial independence. Really, what you aim for is you aim to earn the money, spend the money, and manage the money in a way that makes you happy. That makes you happy today, it makes you happy tomorrow, it makes you happy long term. And that to me isn't financial independence. This is a more realistic understanding of, you know, what money is and why you need it and how you ought to deal with it. That in my definition is financial well-being.
Yeah. No, I really like what you're saying, because I think what we're seeing on social media, I mean, yeah, we see those very successful people who they claim they've achieved financial independence, but not everyone can do that. That's the reality.
No, exactly. I mean, many of these, whatever it is, you know, be it financial independence through Bitcoin, or be it financial independence through rental property, or be it financial, whatever it is, right? So there are many of those who preach you like how to become financially independent with whatever clever strategy they have found works for themselves. And the two things I would say is that, yes, but, you know, perhaps you have become, or these people, they have become very wealthy as a result of, you know, betting on a particular strategy. But, you know, oftentimes, yeah, absolutely, I would say, you know, you've just been lucky and now you're preaching, you know, you're sort of conveying that, you know, the way you've become, you know, this is a way everybody can sort of get rid of all their concerns, etc. And the other thing really is this, as I say, you know, this assumption that only because you have a certain amount of wealth or you have a certain amount of money in the bank account, you know, that all of a sudden all these worries and concerns, etc., are gone. Yeah. So this is oftentimes being implied, right? Now you can live the life you want because you're financially independent. It's not as simple as that. So this is, you know, this nuance, these shades of gray, they are what I offer with the notion of financial well-being.
Absolutely. And in the book, you've got three different parts focusing on different things. So let's briefly discuss each of them. So the first part of the book is titled Money and Money Mindset. So let's talk about our money mindset. Could you share with us what are some of our beliefs or attitudes towards money that really stop us from living prosperous lives or achieving that financial well-being?
Yeah, so there are a few, of course. I mean, when I speak about money mindset, really what I mean are, you know, attitudes, beliefs, emotional reactions, those types of things. And there are, as I say, many. And, you know, I guess the point I'm making is that they're not necessarily wrong. Like when you have a belief, I don't know, something like a penny saved is a penny earned, right? So this may be a belief, and, you know, as a result, you have an attitude towards, you know, saving, and, you know, you shouldn't be spending too much because, you know, your future self will thank you for doing that. And, You know, that's good. That's right, right? Because, you know, this is one of the points of the book. We're not just living today, we're also living tomorrow. But the problem is that the opposite is true as well. Yeah, we're not just living in the future, we're also living now. And as a result, you know, these trade-offs we've got to make between our future selves and our present selves, both in terms of what makes us happy, but also in terms of what gives us financial security, they are really, really hard trade-offs. Yeah. And the beliefs that we have, they very much guide our thinking. And as a result, they lead to blind spots and they lead to behavior that may one way or the other not be beneficial in the long term. So again, a penny saved is a penny earned, right? You know, and saving behavior is good. But I would worry that if this is your attitude or the attitude that follows from that belief, then, you know, perhaps you're becoming a bit too tight in the present. And, you know, you're living just, you know, in favor of your future self at expense of your present self. And you may want to ask yourself as a result, well, you know, is this, you know, one day the life I said, you know, I wanted to have lived? You know, I mean, I give you an example. I have twin children. They're 9 years old. I very much reflect that, you know, I only have 18 summers with them. Yeah. So at 18, they perhaps a bit later, who knows, but they will certainly lose interest in me as a parent. So for now, you know, I will really, you know, enjoy traveling with them. As a result, you know, I spend money on traveling with them as well. You know, even though mathematically, it would be correct to say that the amount of money that I'm putting into the travels, you know, considering how compound interest works, et cetera, would accrue to a certain amount of savings for my retirement if I didn't put it into my travels, but rather put it into my retirement pot. So you see, this is an example for, you know, why you may want to reflect, well, one day you look back to the present and think, well, you know, I wish I would have done this. So this is an example of, you know, why you also ought to be spending sometimes, you know, rather than just saving. And it speaks a little bit to if you have that mindset of, or that belief of, a penny saved is a penny earned. But you know what, there is of course the opposite as well, you know, where, you know, you're completely forgetting the hopes and fears and needs and requirements of your future self. And you just live nowadays, right? Because you have perhaps a money buys happiness type attitude, or, you know, perhaps because you believe, you know, well, it's just destiny, you know, it's not in my control anyway, you know, money will either come or won't, etc. So there are so many different beliefs, and I'm not saying that one of them is wrong. You know, there's always a kernel of truth, as George Kinder put it. There's always a kernel of truth in each belief, but it's not the entire truth. So this is kind of what I suggest when I speak about money mindset, to become aware of your attitudes, your beliefs, and your emotional reactions, because they will serve you well to an extent, but there will also be blind spots, and it will be useful for you to understand those blind spots.
Yeah, I think, as you say in the book, it's about finding that balanced gratification.
Yes.
Yeah. But just so you know, I'm 26 and I'm still traveling with my parents, so you might have more similar situations.
Right. Okay. I've got to save for that part of my future self then as well.
Yeah. You should. You never know. All right. So then the second part of the book, it focuses on emotions, and we know that emotions, whether we realize or not, both they play a role in how we spend our money. But what role do they play in how we manage our money?
Yes, I mean, they are crucial. I mean, the point I'm making here is that emotion, cognition, and motivation, yeah, so how we think, how we feel, and how we act, are in very complex ways working together. And it is a bit outdated to say something like, just think about this rationally. Yeah. So that's not how it works, right? Our brain, you know, we don't have a part of the brain that just thinks rationally, and we don't have a part of the brain that just thinks emotionally. The two are like team players. Yeah. So they like permanently sort of like sense check off each other. They work together. I think the example I give in the book is that when you get a job offer, yeah, you may perhaps consider with a new employer, and you may consider, you know, the salary, the commuting time, perhaps the reporting, you know, that you will sort of interpret what's happening in a factual or rational way, but you will also sense check, you know, well, what will it feel like to have these responsibilities? You know, what may it feel like to, I don't know, be stuck in traffic? You know, how would I feel settle into a new team, etc.? So when assessing that job offer, yeah, we are sort of quick to identify all the things that we're doing rationally, but in reality, we're doing the two together. Now, so we're thinking about them rationally as well as emotionally, because emotion and cognition, they sort of, as I say, they work together. I think the deeper point I'm making here is that we are humans, yeah, and to be human means to have that makeup, yeah, where cognition, emotion, and motivation work together in complex ways. And the point I'm making is that this makeup isn't especially helpful in the times we're living in. And the deeper reflection that I offer is that humans are about, you know, 300,000 years old. We were hunters and gatherers until 12,000 years ago. So for 288,000 of those 300,000 years that we are on the planet, roughly, the vast majority of the time, we were hunters and gatherers. We settled down 12,000 years ago, invented agriculture 12,000 years ago. We invented money 4,000 years ago, and we invented retirement 150 years ago. Yet, you know, our emotional, cognitive, and behavioral makeup is still very much that of the hunters and gatherers, right? So the deeper point is that it's no wonder that we're all a bit messed up when it comes to making good decisions for the longer lives that we are living nowadays, because, you know, we're just absolute beginners when it comes to managing this particular challenge. There's no precedence in history and society and culture and biology, in, you know, evolution and psychology, that would teach us like how to deal with this. So I think this is the deeper point that I'm making here. We have this makeup, and it's normal to be messed up a little bit. Nevertheless, this is the challenge, and that is the challenge that we've got to deal with. And that's the challenge we've got to get on top of. And of course, I offer some like solutions of how that may work.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned retirement, and obviously that's a relatively new concept, and you talk in the book about how it's very difficult for people to invest in our pensions and to think about our future selves, because it's very difficult to relate to that future person. How can we deal with that, because we all know it's important, we have to think about our future selves.
Exactly. I mean, there's beautiful research that I also quote, comes from Hal Hirschfield, a psychologist and behavioral scientist from California, and he has slotted people under an fMRI scanner, and he has invited them to think about their future selves. And what he found was that when people think about their future selves, they activate a part of the brain that processes information of strangers, right? So we have, of course, as humans, we have the capability to distinguish between ourselves and strangers. And you can, you know, see why in evolutionary terms that's of benefit. And what he found is that when we think about our future selves, it's as though we're thinking of strangers, right? So this is just like speaking to your point of, you know, why this is hard. I mean, you know, in a very sort of perhaps like crass way to express it is, you know, when you tell people to take care of your future self and to save money for your future self, it's as though you're telling them to give money to a stranger in the street. Yeah, it's that big mental leap that we've got to make. So one of the things that we found, and this was in the research that we've done at Aegon, but also that others have done, that when you have a positive and intrinsically motivated connection to your future, then you are much more likely to take care of that version of yourself. Yeah. And there's a few things that are important here. One is positive and intrinsically motivated. And I think for a positive connection, you kind of need to know what is it that this person would want. Yeah. So what would give them pleasure? What would give them purpose, etc. That only works when you have a bit of an understanding what is it that gives you pleasure and purpose today, right? Because why would you know what you want in the future if you don't even know that for what that is today? Yeah. So that's one thing. The other is that you want to have, and this is the intrinsically motivated piece. So you want to have an understanding of some really basic components of your future self's lifestyle. Things like, where might you live? What will you be doing day in and day out? Who might you be spending time with? Will you have a pet? You know, these sorts of questions. Like when you start building, when you start finding answers to these questions, yeah, then you build that intrinsically motivated connection to your future, and then it appears much more likely to make decisions in favor of their future self. And by the way, they are not just financial decisions. They could also be health related. They could inform, you know, what sort of relationships you're investing in. They could inform your diet. They could inform, you know, how much you exercise, how much, all those things. Yeah? It's not just about the money. But what we do see is that people who have that intrinsically motivated positive connection to their future self, they are on the financial side much less likely to have high levels of debt, especially, you know, bad debt or expensive debt. They're much more likely to have emergency savings. They're much more likely to have transition funds. They're much more likely to possess the insurance products we consider important, like critical illness and life cover. And of course, they're much more likely to save for retirement. Yeah. So this is and this is regardless of income band. Yeah. So it is across the income bands. If you have a positively and intrinsically motivated connection to your future self, then you are much more likely to make decisions in favor of that future self.
Yeah, very interesting. It's almost like really understanding who you might be in that future and creating that really close relationship with them. But yeah, as I said, very interesting, and many more interesting insights in the book as well. And then you touch briefly on the self-knowledge, which is the third part of the book, and it's also, as you say, the key to financial well-being. So could you expand a little bit on why it's so important? And then I think even the more vital question is, how can we actually define what really matters to us and what we want to do?
Yes, sure. So I think, like, when you take a step back and you think about asset classes, like what type of asset classes are there, right? You're very quick to identify, you know, your income, your property, your savings, your all those things. They are part of your assets, right? Now, the sociology, mainly in the early 80s, they contributed to this discussion by saying that your education is a type of asset. Yeah. Your social networks are a type of asset. Yeah. Your health is a type of asset. So they would make the point that wealth and assets that you need so as to be wealthy, they are much more multifaceted than just things like income and, you know, savings, etc. Now, the point I'm making is that self-knowledge in a 100-year life is a type of asset. Yeah, it's a type of asset class. And what I mean is, in part, it's those things that we talked about, right? Knowledge of what makes you happy, knowledge of, you know, your money mindset, knowledge of what your hopes and fears of your future self may be, etc. But perhaps one more important point to bring into the mix here is the notion of the multi-stage life. Okay, and this is something that I bring in quite often in the book, and is quite crucial to understand the purpose of the book. So back when we as humans invented retirement, What happened at the same time was that we institutionalized and normalized a way of life that is the three-stage life. The three-stage life is first you have education, then you have work, and then you have retirement. Yeah. And when you look about, when you look at it, you know, there's all the, I mean, in Britain, we have the Department of Work and Pensions. We have the Department of Education. We have the, you know, like, or the whole like social state, the whole way the institutions work is around this three-stage life. What I think is increasingly happening, by the way, this is going back to research and an approach framed by Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott, both from the London Business School, who have written about this at length in 100 Year Life, a book, I think, from 2013 or so. It's around for some time now. And what they say is that increasingly, it's a multi-stage life. So we still have something like education in the beginning. We still have something like retirement in the end. But crucially, what retirement means, you know, it means different things to different people. Some people sort of phase into retirement. They phase out of it again, though, you know, because they are not wanting to fully retire or they can't afford to fully retire. But crucially, really, this piece in between that we call work, that has become much more multifaceted. We don't, for a long time, we don't have this, you know, hire to retire, you know, you're with the same employer. That's not the case for a long time already anymore. But increasingly also people have more than just one career. Yeah, they have a first career, they have a second career, they have a third career, and in between they have transition points. And oftentimes that's because they choose to transition to something else, right? Because they lose interest in a job perhaps, or because, you know, the work-life balance isn't right anymore or so. And sometimes also they're forced out of a job. Yeah. So be it the rise of AI or be it robots or whatever, the pace of technological change is faster than it ever was. Okay. But as a result, we don't have this three-stage life anymore, but instead we have a multi-stage life and we have many more transitions in between. Now, I believe this is, to come back to self-knowledge, this is why I think self-knowledge is so important, because you can only make the right decisions in these transition points, yeah, if you have an understanding of what is it that makes you happy, what is it that gives you purpose, what is it you would want for the next 5 to 10 years or so, right? So this is what I mean with self-knowledge being so crucial for a happy long life, because you're deemed to make wrong decisions for yourself if you don't know these essential things about yourself. So sorry, it's a long answer, and I've only answered part of it, because the other question you asked was, how do we identify this? Yeah. So how do we identify what makes us happy? Yeah. And here I'm very much inspired by the work that comes from Professor Paul Dolan, who is a behavioral scientist at the London School of Economics, who says that happiness is an even balance of pleasure and purpose, right? So pleasure moments, activities, things are, you know, all the things that give you joy, that give you relaxation, that give you gratification in a sort of, you know, normal or regular understanding of the word. But then he would say what is equally important to pleasure is purpose, right? And what he means with purpose is, you know, things, activities, experiences that make you feel worthwhile, that make you feel competent, that make you feel useful. And, you know, that doesn't have to be big P purpose type things. That can be really banal things, right? I did the school drop off this morning, right? So, I mean, you know, it's not exactly that I come back and feel like, oh, that was competent. But, you know, it gives me a sense of purpose, like a little bit it does, right? I'm involved in the parent council in the school, right? So, you know, tomorrow we have the summer party. So I'm contributing there, right? So that makes me feel useful, etc. So things like that, right? So you want to have an understanding of what are these moments, experiences, activities that give you a sense of joy and that give you a sense of purpose. So this is really what you want to reflect on. You want to look at, you know, the experiences that give you that give you joy, that give you purpose, rather than, and I won't go into this now, but people can read this up on the book, but you know, rather than what you tell yourself makes you happy or gives you purpose.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, you mentioned the 100 year life, so obviously we live in a time with a lot of advancements in medical advancements and also We've seen a lot of AI advancements, which are again helping with how long we live. But the truth is, we were not prepared to plan for such a long lives, such a long life. So, what challenges does this bring to in terms of financial planning, but also in terms of those decisions you just commented on? How does it make it more different when we live longer?
Yeah, I mean the real big challenge is that the onus is on us. Yeah. So because when we invented retirement 150 years ago, the model was really don't worry about it because we've got your back. Because there is the state pension. And of course, when it was invented just what 1886, I want to say, by Bismarck in Germany. And of course, then that model was applied by many others as well, and many other countries as well. And back then it was only, I think it was only like 125,000 or so who actually got it, right? So it's a really small number. But of course, then it expanded, the welfare state expanded for a really long period. And ever more people got included. And I think nowadays, to just contrast those 125,000 in Germany who were the first recipient of the state pension, today it's something like 27 million. Okay. So it's expanded a lot. But of course, welfare states, they increasingly realize, oh, bummer, we can't afford this, right? And this old contract doesn't really work anymore. So really what's happening is the burden of long-term planning is being placed on individuals' shoulders. Yeah, and that's a big challenge. But the whole thing, that the whole argument of the book is this is first and foremost a mental challenge. Yeah, so of course it is a financial challenge. It's first and foremost a mental challenge because as humans, we are not wired to think that way. Yeah, we've got to adapt and we've got to learn this. So it goes back to many of the points that I said, right? That in order to manage that challenge of needing to plan for a long time, well, we've got to understand that we are in charge. You are the everyone listening. You are in charge of your retirement ship. There's no one else taking care of you. It's you. The onus is on you, and that's a mental challenge. Now, the way you tackle this is there is a financial side, of course. I don't disregard this, but the first thing that you want to be mindful of is those instincts, those attitudes, those beliefs, those emotional reactions that you have on the money mindset side. You want to have an understanding of the things that impede you as well, right? So because this, I think, is another component of self-knowledge and a really unfair element in the mix, because even though there is this onus on long-term planning on individuals' shoulders, we also live in an environment that is very much appealing to instant gratification. Yeah, be that how the phones work, be that how the news work, be that how online retail works, etc. All those things. There's a reason why on Amazon the yellow button doesn't just say buy, it says buy now. Yeah, and there's a reason for that, of course, because that because they know, not just online retail, but many of these players, they know how our brains work, yeah, and how to sort of make us do something that is perhaps not necessarily in our long-term interest. So this is something where I say, this is really important to understand and get on top of. So how instincts are being played with. But the other components, as I said, understanding of what are your centers, right? Are you family centered? Are you work centered? Are you partner centered? Are you community centered? Faith centered? Gain that understanding of yourself, because if you do, then you're much more likely to make decisions that are in favor of, both present self and what is important to present self, and future self and what is important to future self.
And I think all of that leads to, well, I have to admit it's a very difficult question to answer in a few minutes, but how can we create a financial plan after doing all of that and really understanding who we are and what we want to do and where we want to be in the future? How can we create a financial plan that will help us lead that prosperous life?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm glad you bring in the money, because I make it sound in the course of this conversation, I make it sound as though it's just mindset. And of course, it's not just mindset, because money is important. In the book, again, I use the metaphor of an ingredient. The money is an ingredient, right? So when you bake a loaf of bread, you need yeast, you need flour, you need water, you need salt, etc. You don't need just flour, you don't need just yeast, you don't need, that's the point. So the same applies with money, right? It's an ingredient. You don't just need money, you need money and other ingredients as well. But money is an important ingredient as well. So obviously, you know, I'm not, when speaking to a mass audience, like on this podcast, I cannot give individual advice. I mean, neither should I, because I'm not a financial advisor. So what I do instead is I give some rules of thumb. Yeah. Rules of thumb. I think I really like rules of thumb because they kind of, you know, appreciate how the brain works. And one of the rules of thumb, so as in, you know, you're finding it much easier to remember rules of thumb than, you know, complex technical advice. So one of the rules of thumb that I really like is the 50-30-20 rule of thumb. Yeah. So where 50% of your net income you spend on the everyday needs. Yeah. So that be either your mortgage repayments or your rent, be it groceries, the, you know, the bills, etc., those things. 30% of your income you spend on your wants. Okay. So these are things like, you know, your holidays, you're going out with partner and friends, you know, hobbies, whatever gives you that sense of pleasure and purpose. And then 20% are nominated or dedicated to improving your financial situation. And what that is depends a little bit on where you are, right? So if you have high levels of expensive debt, then I would say use the 20% to pay off that debt. If you don't have debt, but you don't have emergency savings, yeah, then use the 20% to build up emergency savings. Here, another rule of thumb would be something between 3 and 6 months. Yeah. If you're self-employed, then perhaps more on the side of 6 months. If you're, you know, employed, then perhaps more on a 3 months would suffice, just for like dealing with things like, you know, the car breaks down, or I don't know, there's a leak in the bathroom or whatever. And if you have emergency savings, then I would say you don't have expensive debt, you have the emergency savings, then I would say use the 20% to build up transition funds. Now, transition funds, no one speaks about transition funds really, but transition funds speak a little bit to what I said there earlier, that we have far more transitions in a 100-year life or in a multi-stage life. Yeah. And we want to be able, or we need to be able, to fund these transitions. Because if we don't have that ability, then we're perhaps trapped in a job that sucks the life out of us. Or perhaps we don't have the ability to step in when, you know, our elderly parents need help, and we need to take time off, or, you know, we don't have the ability to, I don't know, if the kids need more moral support or whatever, you know, or if an issue with the after school club or whatever, you know. So there will be, so you need money, I believe, in the multi-stage life for these transitions, and this is different, in my opinion, to emergency savings. When emergency savings are really to deal with like tangible issues, transition funds are there to support you in the points of transitions. Now, and if you have all that, right, if you have emergency savings, if you have transition funds, if you have no high levels of debt, expensive debt especially, then prioritize longer term goals like retirement, or, you know, saving up for mortgage payment, etc. So yeah, that's one rule of thumb. Now, the other thing in the spirit of balanced gratification, I would say, is, you know, that won't always be possible, the 50-30-20. And what I would say is aim for 50-30-20 sort of like on average. Yeah. And if that isn't possible, ask yourself, or it doesn't seem achievable, ask yourself, like, you know, is the deviation, I mean, if you're finding yourself, if you're finding it's, I don't know, 70, 20, 10, or 40, 30, 30, instead of 50, 30, 20, you know, wants, needs, and improve your financial situation. Then ask yourself, is that justified? Because perhaps it is, right? Perhaps it works for you. Perhaps it's all right. You know, perhaps because there's something that, you know, I don't know, perhaps you can expect an inheritance, or perhaps, you know, you're a civil servant and absolute, you know, you know, secure in your job. I, you know, there could be things, right, that justify a deviation from 50, 30, 20. But just ask yourself a question, you know, is it justified? Yeah, that's what I would say on the financial side and what you would want to consider in a financial plan.
Yeah. And again, it's about really knowing yourself
Yes.
and what works for you. Great.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I love that. I think probably that's the key to everything that we've discussed today. And so thank you very much, Tom, for your time today. It was a very interesting conversation. And I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of Your Path to Prosperity to read even more about everything we've discussed today. Because, yeah, you've got some great insights and stories in there. But thank you very much for today.
Thank you for having me. It was a joy.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.